The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and major public research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries at UWM today. Here's the host of UWM Today, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor for University Relations and Communications.
A UWM astronomer is part of a team of scientists that recently made a major discovery in the study of our universe. They found what may be the coldest white dwarf star ever. This is a story more than 11 billion years in the making, and the amazing part is what that star is made of. Joining us in the studio is David Kaplan, Associate Professor of Physics and a member of the Leonard E. Parker Center for Gravitation, Cosmology, and Astrophysics at UWM. David, welcome back to the program. You've been on before talking about your work, and we're thrilled that you could join us again today.
Well, I'm really happy to be here. Thank you very much.
So this was quite the deal. There have been a lot of newspaper stories. This story about your discovery, the discovery you and your colleagues made, has sort of taken on a life of its own because it is intriguing to imagine what may be out there, and you folks stumbled upon it.
That's right. This is one of the more fanciful things that we find out in the universe, but the story of how we sort of came to these conclusions is sort of interesting on its own.
Well, first, let's talk about what you found, and then we're going to reveal to our audience, since I've teased it up here, what we think that big, big star might be made of. First of all, what were you looking for?
So this was part of a project with myself and a number of other colleagues in the U.S. and Europe, and what we were trying to find were pulsars. And a pulsar is the remains of a star that started out about 10 times the size of our sun, and it had a very short, violent life, and it explodes. And after it explodes, it leaves behind something which is about the size of Milwaukee, but has the mass of the sun squeezed into it. So it's the densest thing that we know of in the universe. It's denser even than the nucleus of an atom. And this thing is not only really dense, but it's also spinning around very fast. So it's spinning around 30 times every second, sort of like a 33 record, if you remember what those are. So if you can imagine being in Milwaukee spinning around 30 times a second, it's a really extreme environment. And for reasons that we're still not 100% sure of, it sends out beams of radio waves, sort of like the beams from a lighthouse. So once every 33 milliseconds, the beams from this lighthouse sweep across the Earth, and we receive a little blip in our radio telescope. Now, this is a very faint little blip of radio waves. So we have a very big radio transmitter on top of this building, and there are many like that across the country. So in order to see these very faint radio waves coming from space, we have to go to a place in the country where there aren't any radio towers. We go to the National Radio Quiet Zone, which is located in the mountains of West Virginia, and we use the Robert C. Byrd Radio Telescope, the Green Bank Telescope, which is basically a football field that you can point anywhere in the sky.
And you did this looking for that signal that was emanating from this tiny star.
That's right. And we do this to find a number of different types of pulsars, and we use them for a variety of different sort of astrophysical goals. And we have undergraduates at UWM doing this today. They'll be using the radio telescope over the weekend, and then they'll look through the data during the week to try to find new pulsars. This particular pulsar was found by somebody, Jason Boyles, who was at that time a graduate student at West Virginia University. And he found the pulsar, and he said, okay, that looks like a sort of interesting pulsar. But once you find it, that's really only the beginning of the story. And then is when you start digging in deeper to understand what's going on.
Well, let's unfold that story. What was it that was unique or special about this pulsar as opposed to the many others that might be found during the routine scan of the skies?
So we found this pulsar, and as I said, it's spinning around 30 times a second. And pulsars are among the best clocks in the universe. They're better than some of the best atomic clocks on the Earth. So we can figure out exactly when these pulses should arrive. And we found that instead of arriving when we thought they should, they were coming 11 seconds earlier and 11 seconds later and 11 seconds earlier and 11 seconds later. And this was, well, it would have been mysterious had this sort of phenomenon not been discovered 40 years ago. And what turned out was happening was that the pulsar was orbiting around some other object. Some star that we couldn't see was orbiting around with the pulsar once every 2.5 days. So sometimes it was further away from us and we received the pulses later. Sometimes it was closer to us and we received the pulses earlier.
So you were getting the signal from this pulsar, but you didn't know what it was that was in the way, what it essentially was circling around.
That's right. All we knew was some object that didn't emit radio waves. And so then we started digging in deeper. So one of my colleagues, Adam Deller in the Netherlands, decided that he wanted to figure out how far away this pulsar was. And it's a very hard measurement to make, and he's very good at it. So we used a network of radio telescopes located across the continental U.S. and beyond, so stretching everywhere from Hawaii to the Caribbean. And he figured out exactly where this pulsar was. And he did this through a technique called parallax, which is like if you hold your thumb out in front of your eye and you close your left eye and you close your right eye, the background appears to move. So he did this on a cosmic scale, except the change that he saw was really tiny. The change that he saw in the position of the pulsar was about the size of a hamster held in California, seen in Boston. And he was able to measure the amount of this change to about the size of the hamster's eye. So it was a really amazing change. And he figured out that this pulsar was about 867 light years away from us. That might seem like a lot, but for a pulsar, it's actually pretty close. And moreover, he could say that it was 867 light years on the nose. His measurement was so precise that we could tell exactly where this was. It was 5 quadrillion miles away. And that meant that we could start doing some more detailed investigation of what's going on here.
And so the puzzle began to come together at that point. You knew that you had this pulsar, which is not unusual, circling something that was unusual. You weren't quite sure what it was.
That's right. And we knew that we couldn't see it initially, even though we knew where to look. So we knew it wasn't a star like our sun. So it had to be one of two other things. It could be another neutron star, which is what a pulsar is, just one where we don't see the pulses, or it could be something we call a white dwarf, which is what our sun will turn into in about another 5 billion years. So a white dwarf is sort of like a neutron star, except instead of collapsing down to the size of Milwaukee, it collapses down to the size of the Earth. So it's still pretty extreme, but it's not as extreme as a neutron star. And what we wanted to do was figure out which of these could it be. So the first test was that we needed to figure out what its mass was. We know that neutron stars tend to have more mass than white dwarfs. And we measured its mass by using a trick of general relativity. But it turned out that mass didn't really tell us the whole story. It was sort of right in between where these two things could be. It was remarkably confusing. And then we said, okay, well, can we see it? We said, we know exactly where it is. We know exactly how far away it is. Can we see what's there? And we looked with some of the biggest telescopes in the world. We used a 10-meter Keck telescope on top of a mountain in Hawaii, and we couldn't see it. And this was a puzzle because in astronomy, if you can't see something, well, it could always be further away than you thought, or it could always be smaller than you thought. But in this case, we knew exactly how far away it was, and we knew exactly how big it was. So, okay, is it a white dwarf or is it a neutron star? Why can't we see it? If it's a neutron star, you don't expect to see it. But we measured this orbit. We measured that the pulsar pulses 11 seconds earlier and 11 seconds later. And we can measure the shape of the pulsar's orbit. Now, the Earth orbits around the sun in a shape that's pretty close to a circle, but it's not exactly a circle. It's slightly elliptical, slightly egg-shaped. And the amount of this ellipticity, how different it is from a circle, tells us about what's happened in the Earth's past. We saw that the orbit of this pulsar around whatever it was orbiting around was really close to a circle, much better than the Earth, in fact. And this told us that it can't be a neutron star. Whatever it's orbiting around cannot be a neutron star because a neutron star comes from an exploding star. And if you can imagine having a perfect circle and sending off an explosion, you don't end up with a perfect circle anymore.
You have a disrupted field.
Yeah. That's right. So you have something that's going to be very, very egg-shaped. And in this case, we know it was a perfect circle. So we know it can't be a pulsar and another neutron star. It has to be a pulsar and a white dwarf. But it's a white dwarf that we don't see. And that means it has to be among the coldest white dwarfs ever, or at least that we know where to look. So we started figuring out what this white dwarf would be made of. Now, if you let our sun go on for about another 5 billion years, it spends most of that time turning hydrogen into helium, and we get light as a byproduct. Close to the end of its life, some of that helium will start turning into carbon and oxygen in the inside, more nuclear reactions, but these only go on for a very short amount of time. But once the star turns into a white dwarf, the carbon and oxygen is going to be what's left over. So we knew that we had something that was about the mass of our sun made of carbon and oxygen, which was among the coldest of these white dwarfs ever seen. And people 50 years ago started realizing that when you take these white dwarfs, which are made of carbon, and you make them colder and colder and colder, eventually this carbon will not be sort of a hot bubbling gas, but will turn into a solid. And we have a special name for solid carbon here. Well, we have a few different special names. We have graphite, we have buckyballs, but this particular type is closest to what we call diamond. So what we have basically is a diamond with the mass of the sun, the size of the Earth, sitting 867 light years away from us.
A giant, giant diamond floating way, way, way beyond our reach.
That's right. So it's a pretty amazing discovery. It's among the coldest and oldest white dwarfs ever. So it must have formed very early in the history of the Milky Way, and it's just been cooling down ever since. So sort of like you can use the temperature of a campfire to figure out when the last fire was after it's been put out.
You look at the embers in there?
That's right. So the white dwarf is a cosmic ember. The fire went out 11 billion years ago, and it's been cooling ever since. So our hope is that we can use the temperature of the white dwarf that we measure now to figure out exactly how much stuff is in there and how it's been cooling, because there's still some unanswered questions about how that works.
Well, you're using radio waves to form these hypotheses on what is or what isn't up there. If we were able to travel those 830 million light years, I think you said, if we were able to physically see it, what would it look like? Do we have any idea?
Well, I said it's among the coldest white dwarfs ever, but cold for an astronomer is not the same as cold for a normal person. So when I say cold, it's probably about 2,000 degrees. So it's still hot enough to burn you. You wouldn't touch it, and it's still sort of a glowing object the size of the Earth, and it would have enough mass to suck you down and sort of crush you on the surface. But most of these white dwarfs tend to be 20 or 30 or 40,000 degrees. So for us, 2,000 degrees is cold.
Would it sparkle? Would it have any of the appearances that a diamond would have here on this Earth?
Well, the inside would be not entirely like the diamond we have on Earth because it's somewhat denser, but it's sort of close. It has a sort of dusting of hydrogen on the outside, though. It has a little bit of hydrogen that comes probably from a mixture of what the star was originally made of and hydrogen that it sucked down from the interstellar gas. And so this sort of dusting of hydrogen will shield whatever we see on the inside. So you'd sort of have to dig down probably a couple kilometers in order to see exactly what it was made of. But if you can travel 867 light years, I think you can dig down through a few kilometers of hydrogen too without too much difficulty.
So how many of these types of white dwarfs, I was going to call it a planet, but it's not, even though it might have some appearance of some substance there. How many are there out there?
They're actually really common. So most of the stars in our galaxy will turn into these white dwarfs at the end of our life. Our sun will do this. Most of the stars you see in the night sky will turn into these white dwarfs. It just takes some time. So there are a lot of these floating around out there in space. We just don't know exactly where. The reason that we know exactly where this one is because we've seen this pulsar orbiting around it.
And what is unique here is that it's as old as it is. And is that one of the reasons why it's been able to cool down as much as it has?
That's right. So it's really, really old. And there are other white dwarfs where people think, okay, maybe it's old, or maybe we just don't know really how far away it is, or maybe we just don't really know how big it is, or there are a number of different reasons why we don't see it. And in this case, all of the sort of check boxes are checked off. We know exactly how far away it is. We know exactly how big it is. We know exactly where it is. But we still don't see it, and so therefore it must be really, really cold.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. Good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack, and joining us in the studio, David Kaplan, UWM Associate Professor of Physics and member of a team of scientists that made a major discovery recently, the discovery of what may be the oldest, coldest white dwarf seen yet. And as it turns out, we believe it may be looking a lot like a diamond. If we had a comparable piece here on Earth, that probably is the closest that we can come to it. David, it's a fascinating detective story that you tell on how you and your colleagues got to the point that you are, where you believe you now have a good idea of what's going on here. How complex of a discovery process was this compared to the other work that you normally do day in and day out as a physicist?
This was remarkably satisfying because we were able to tell a story that had an interesting conclusion without a lot of the sort of hedging and other wishy-washiness that often comes up in astronomy. As I said, we often don't know very well how far away things are, how old they are. These are really hard to measure when you're talking about stars that are billions of miles away. So the fact that we could sort of eliminate all these other hypotheses here and come to a single conclusion that we think is pretty robust has been quite satisfying. I had colleagues email me. They're like, you know, I started reading your paper and I didn't believe you, but by the end, that was the only option. So it's sort of nice that we came to something that was not only solid, but also interesting and makes for good sort of cocktail party conversation.
What does it say or inform us about the origins of the universe? Is there anything to be learned from this discovery that might help give us a deeper understanding of that universe?
Yeah, that's a good question. So very old white dwarfs, we were talking about embers before, cosmic embers, and very old white dwarfs are used to figure out how old the universe is. So when I was in graduate school, there were a number of different ways to figure out how old the universe was. And a lot of them actually didn't agree very well. Some of them said that the oldest stars were older than the universe, which is an impossibility. So this detective work to figure out how old things are, how these cosmic embers cool, turned out to be a very important piece of that. And now we have some more modern observations from things like the cosmic microwave background that tell us pretty well how old the universe is. So we know that number, but we're still trying to figure out how the Milky Way galaxy formed, how stars like our sun formed, how other sorts of stars in our galaxy formed. And so understanding the very earliest parts of the formation of our galaxy and what's in it is a really important piece of that puzzle. So looking at this one white dwarf star, well, this tells us one story, tells us how this one star formed. But now what we're trying to do is figure out, okay, if we know what this one white dwarf looks like, can we use this to figure out if we have a whole bunch of other white dwarfs where we don't know quite as much information, can we use this to sort of calibrate what's going on there and figure out how cold and how old they are?
Now, I understand that although you've written the paper, you and your colleagues have come to some conclusions here, you're not done looking at this star. I understand that you're going to be able to get yet one more powerful tool put into your hands to look even more closely at this.
That's right. So we've been granted time on the Hubble Space Telescope. The first observations will hopefully come up in December. So the Hubble Space Telescope can provide a sort of deeper, more decisive look at it than the Keck telescopes that we used before. And so hopefully what the Hubble Space Telescope will tell us is that the white dwarf is there. It's just very cold. And then we'll be able to use those observations to figure out exactly how cold. Is it 2,000? Is it 2,500? Is it 1,500? It'll be able to answer that question.
And as you begin to put a more definitive mark on just how cold it is, it will perhaps position it in terms of the ranking of other dwarfs that are out there.
That's right. So saying that it's the coldest and saying that it's the oldest are two different things. We know that it's very cold, and it's probably the coldest that we've seen so far. But the oldest is a harder question to answer because, again, it's like these sort of cosmic embers. We know how cold it is now when we measure it. But figuring out, going back in time to figuring out when that fire was put out is a harder question to answer. And that depends on how big the embers are, what they're made of, what sort of stuff is around them. All those questions apply in the case of the white dwarf too. So that is the piece of the puzzle that we're hoping to use these Hubble Space Telescope observations to sort out. Exactly how old is it? And figure out how does this compare to other old white dwarfs that people have seen? There are probably white dwarfs in our galaxy that are older. There are something called globular clusters orbiting around our galaxy that are even older than the majority of the Milky Way itself. And they probably have white dwarfs that are even older than this white dwarf. But at least for the ones we've seen so far, they're not colder.
What I find really interesting about the story is that you're looking backwards and you're looking, in this case, at stars that have died.
That's right.
They've finished their life and this is sort of the graveyard of stars. But while you're looking at what has happened and what has come to an end, at the same time in the universe, there are lots of examples that you see of stars being born.
That's definitely true. There are many places in our galaxy where you can study stars being born. It's a very, very complicated process that we really don't understand in great detail. We can sort of set out the basics of what happens. But it's sort of like weather on the Earth. We can understand the basics, but we can predict a few days ahead, but doing anything longer than that gets very complicated. And so understanding the formation of stars is equally difficult. And the same thing goes for the very end of stars. We can sort of middle life, that's pretty easy to understand. But when stars are going through the very late stages of their lives, right before they explode, and during that explosion, that's, again, a very, very puzzling time for them. And it's something where there are a lot of efforts right now to understand different aspects of it and then to piece it together into sort of a single view of what happens.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the methods that you folks used, you and your colleagues used, to spot this pulsar in the first place that then led to this other discovery. You talked about radio telescopes being used here in the U.S. and over in Europe. I've heard that you can see from the northern hemisphere stars that you cannot see as easily from the southern hemispheres. Did that figure into this at all? Did you work primarily with people who were in a position to see these radio waves or capture them because of where they were located when they were doing the looking?
Well, we use radio telescopes, which are basically like big satellite dishes hooked up to very expensive computers. And most of the time, we're not actually located where the radio telescopes are. Because, well, that used to be how it was back when I was in school. But now computers are so good, the internet's so good, that I can control a radio telescope from my laptop. And it's much more efficient for me to do it that way. Now, we still go there every once in a while just so we can learn exactly how to use it and meet the people there. But we don't have to go every single time. This particular star happens to be right about on the equator. So if you sort of take the Earth's equator and project it into space, that's right where this particular white dwarf and pulsar are. So that means that we could have used telescopes in the northern hemisphere, like those in the U.S., or we could have used telescopes in the southern hemisphere, like those in Australia. For this particular project, we started with a telescope in the U.S. in West Virginia, and then we used other telescopes located in Hawaii and throughout the continental U.S. But we also actually used a telescope located in Chile in South America to look for the optical light from the white dwarf, which we haven't seen yet. And then, of course, Hubble Space Telescope is in orbit around the Earth. So a lot of it comes down to what telescopes do you know how to use, which ones will let you do what you want to do. I don't just call up a telescope and say, hey, I found something cool. Can I have a little bit of data? I have to write a proposal to a panel of scientists who will rank all of them, and then the top so many proposals get to decide, that sounds good, we'll do that project, or that one doesn't quite convince me, come back, try again.
You talked about how satisfying it was in this instance to have a conclusion to your detective story. But yet most of the work that you do probably doesn't fall neatly into categories where you have a beginning, middle, and an end to the story. Does that frustrate you as a physicist? Or is that just one of the occupational hazards that you learn to live with, the uncertainty that comes with maybe not knowing the answers to the questions that are formulated by your research?
I think a little bit of both. I wish things were neatly tied up. I could just draw a line under it and say, this project is done. We know everything there is to know about this one object.
Shut the machine down. We're done for the day. We got this one figured out, right?
That's right. But the universe is really, really complicated, and rarely do we find clean answers. It's usually the case that we can come to some conclusions, but then the next person who takes a look might come to entirely different conclusions. And the whole process of science is trying to reconcile those conclusions with the data that we all find. And, I mean, in the end, it is a remarkable process that we have learned so much that we have up to this point. White dwarfs were first seen about 150 years ago. Neutron stars were only seen about 50 years ago. And yet we already know so much about how they form and how they evolve.
How competitive are astronomers or physicists like you when it comes to making these sorts of discoveries?
I like to think that I'm a good collaborator, so I'm very eager to get students involved and other colleagues involved in the work, and there have been many of my colleagues involved here. We also worked with some students at University of North Carolina and at Caltech on making the optical observations, and they provided really crucial roles in doing all this. Where we really tend to compete is in the scarce resources. So Hubble Space Telescope, about 10 times as many people want to use the telescope as there is time available. So I had to submit a proposal saying, this is what we think we've seen. This is what we want to do to come up with some better answers. What do you think? And they decided that our proposal was good enough, which meant that 90% of the other people didn't get to use it. So that's where most of the competition comes in, for telescope time and other scarce resources like that.
Do you ever have situations where you or one of your colleagues stumbles upon a fact that you think may lead in a direction where you say, gee, I hope nobody else gets here first. We would love to be the ones who write the paper on this.
I have been scooped, and I have scooped other people. So a lot of the data that we get comes from telescopes which are operated by the federal government. And the federal government says, okay, if you want to do a project, great, you get to do what you want. But after a year, everybody else can look at your data. And that's a really good policy. But it means that after a year, if my graduate student hasn't quite finished everything, or if I've been busy and I haven't quite written the paper, somebody else gets to write the paper. So you got to keep moving. You can't really rest. There's always more work to do, and there are always more people who will do it if you don't.
So you've discovered what you think may be the coldest white dwarf, you and your colleagues. Is there anything else on the immediate horizon, pardon the pun, of what you might hope to find or learn that no one else has seen yet? Or is that a trade secret? Aren't we going to go there yet?
Well, I wish I had another shocking discovery. Right now, most of the stuff we're working on is interesting, but it's not quite as sort of fanciful. We found a very interesting pulsar last year where it's a pulsar that's orbited by not one but two white dwarfs. And that's a very fascinating system, and we're studying it. We've written a couple papers on it already, and one of our main goals there is to try to use the observations of this pulsar to understand how gravity works. Basically, does gravity act on a big thing and a small thing the same way? And we have observations and work going on right now that we hope can answer that question.
And is this work being done with fellow colleagues here in the U.S., or is this another international effort?
It's another international effort. So people in the U.S., people in Canada, and one of the main people doing this is a postdoc in the Netherlands.
But I meant to ask this question last time you were on. Do you all speak English? When you're working with physicists around the world, is English the common language, or do you have to move back and forth between different languages?
No, we speak English. All of our conferences are in English. All of our papers are in English. Not everybody's English is as good as everybody else's. I work with a lot of Dutch colleagues, and their English tends to be a lot better than mine, actually. So they correct my grammar, and I have to try to keep up with them. But we also work with colleagues in, say, Asia, where their native English isn't as good, but their papers are still plenty easy to understand.
Does nationalism ever get into the mix here, where one country's a group of physicists competing against another?
They do in terms of some of these resources. So where one telescope will only be available to people in one country and a different telescope will only be available to people in a different country. But mostly we all get along pretty well. The individual scientists, most of us collaborate with people in a range of countries.
One more question. Resources, big issue for you. Do you think that our country is doing all that it needs to do to remain competitive in terms of funding or financing the work that you and others are doing?
My colleagues and I spend a lot of time trying to get students involved at a variety of levels in this work. We work with high school students and undergraduates, getting them into research. But funding is always difficult. This telescope in West Virginia, the government has been saying that they might have to shut it down for lack of resources. When you look at the total amount of money spent on astronomy, it's really minuscule compared to many other uses of federal funds. Now, admittedly, it's not nearly as pressing as, say, feeding people or healthcare, but it's such a great way to energize and get people excited about science and technology. And many of the students that we work with go on to careers in a whole range of really important and interesting fields. And so we think that this sort of science education and research is a really valuable investment for the future.
Well, David, clearly you're using your resources wisely. Congratulations on the discovery. And we look forward to having you on again in the future as you help us understand the skies around us.
Thank you very much.
David Kaplan, UWM Associate Professor of Physics, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. That's all for this week's program. We'll see you next week at the same time. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujack.
You have been listening to UWM Today, the weekly program where you meet faculty, staff, and students at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee who help make a difference in the lives of people in southeastern Wisconsin through their teaching, research, and community service. To learn more about UWM, go online to uwm.edu.